This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Finance Advisory are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Goes a sorrowing. That quote comes from Ben Franklin, but it was recalled to us neither by America's president nor Britain's prime minister. Instead, the Daily Telegraph in London reported it from the mouth of Cheng Siwei, a quote, top member of the communist hierarchy. Well, what goes around comes around. The Anglo-Saxons have forgotten what makes a successful economy. The Chinese have remembered. Just look up Warren Harding on Wikipedia. The first entry you will find is not the 29th President of the United States of America, but a rock climber with the same name. But what do you expect? History is nothing but a long list of disasters in chronological order. Historians love calamity, and they reserve their highest accolades for those who cause them. The same is true in financial history. Those who make it big are those who make it worse. It is safe to assume that no one working at the Federal Reserve or at the White House has a picture of Warren Gamaliel Harding over his desk. Yet, if American presidents were ranked on the basis of how well they faced up to financial disaster, Warren G. Harding might be somebody. His handsome face would be carved on Rushmore. His likeness would grace the $100 bill. Harding was the last American president to deal honestly with a major financial crisis. Every president since has tried to scam his way out of it. By the time Harding took office in 21, the panic of 1920 was taking the unemployment rate from 4% to nearly 12%. GDP fell 17%. Then, as now, the president's subordinates urged him to intervene. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover wanted to meddle, as he would 10 years later. But Harding resisted. No bailouts, no stimulus, no monetary policy, no fiscal policy. Harding had a better approach. He cut government spending and went out to play poker. Quote, "We will attempt intelligent and courageous deflation and strike at government borrowing, which enlarges the evil, and we will attack high cost of government with every energy and facility which attend Republican capacity. It will be an example to stimulate thrift and economy in private life. Let us call for a nationwide drive against extravagance and luxury, to a recommittal to simplicity of living, to that prudent and normal plan of life which is the health of republic." End of quote. Within a decade, Harding's views were collectibles. But in 1921, he saw the economic world as a moral world ordered not by man but by God. This was not the result of long study or deep reflection on his part. He was probably the dummy everybody said he was. As Keynes pointed out, politicians are always in thrall of some dead economist. At least Harding was in thrall to the good ones. Quote, "No statute enacted by man can repeal the inexorable laws of nature." Our most dangerous tendency is to expect too much of government. End of quote. Harding was not the first to see the economy as a natural order, one that you disturbed at your peril. A Taoist named Zhuangzi, who lived about the same time as Alexander, observed, "Good order results spontaneously when things are let alone." Later, economists of the Scottish Enlightenment, notably Adam Smith and Adam Ferguson, elaborated, "Smith, like Harding, saw the economy ordered by the invisible hand of God. Ferguson saw markets in a spontaneous order, which were the result of human action, but not the execution of any human design." The same basic insight led Irving Fisher, the greatest economist of the 1920s, to come up with his debt deflation theory of depression. After people had borrowed, they needed to pay back. Busts followed booms. There was no getting around it. Warren Harding may never have been the brightest bulb on the White House porch, but intuitively he understood that proper macroeconomic policies were more the product of virtue than of genius. Debt led to trouble. That's all he needed to know. Keynes came along a few years later. Keynes was a genius. Everybody said so. And he had an answer for everything. Nature? Government could do better. Debt? Don't worry about it, he said. Why not just let capitalism sort itself out? Without government intervention, it will only get worse, said Keynes. But Harding had already proved him wrong. Harding did the very opposite of what Keynes recommended. Instead of increasing government spending, he reduced it. He cut the budget almost in half. He slashed taxes, too, and cut the national debt by a third. Japan at the time struggled with the same downturn, but it had no Harding at the helm. Instead, its masters prefigured Keynes, trying to stay the correction using price controls and other interventions. The result was a long, drawn-out affair that lasted until 1927 and ended in a bank crisis. In America, meanwhile, by 1922, unemployment was back down to 6.7%. By 1923, it was down further to 2.4%. This lesson was entirely lost on the world's economists. When the next crisis hit a decade later, they turned to Keynes. Of course, it turned out to be a moral world. After all, they got what they deserved. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that comes from the inimitable pen of Bill Bonner, whose material I like to quote frequently and have done so in the past, and doubtless will continue to do so in the future. He has a way with words, and frankly, in the financial arena today, I don't think anybody comes close. Anyway, there you go, Bill Bonner on the recession of 1921. Okay, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you from Singapore through the good offices of our studios in Manhattan, New York. Our toll-free number, which, as always, I encourage you to use, would be 888-873-4643. Once again, toll-free number to contact me and get your questions either answered or discussed, and your rants heard, would be toll-free 888-873-4643. And if you would like to send your emails with the same questions and comments, you may do that too. My email is open, ready to receive them, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. RM stands for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, my email here is rm@gfawd.com. And finally, for those of you who would like to call me in private, you may call me about your concerns by calling 941-441-1682. And that is our local Sarasota, Florida phone number, or rather my direct Sarasota, Florida telephone number, which will toggle straight through to Singapore at no expense to your good selves. And once again, the number to call is 941-441-1682. All right. So some of you may have heard of Christina Romer. Christina Romer is on the Obama Administration Council of Economic Advisors, and she has recently been talking about the lessons from the Great Depression for economic recovery in 2009. Unfortunately, she is but yet another one with totally hopeless views about the lessons of Japan. She talks with complete nonsense about Japan. She is a true believer in the free lunch theory of economics, that one can spend one's way out of a problem of too much debt. Logically, of course, it cannot be done. Romer may currently be known best for her misinterpretation of what happened in 1937 to 38. She believes that the fallback into full-scale depression from depression light, as she calls the unemployment in 1938 almost returning to the highest levels of depression trough in 32-33, is proof that it was a mistake to tighten policy, both fiscal and monetary, too early. In other words, according to her, if the Fed had continued pumping as furiously as possible, then everything would have been all right. Well, in reality, the entire inflationary mini-boomlet within the depression was simply an illusion. GDP growth that is bought with monetary pumping and feckless fiscal spending only misdirects and ultimately consumes even more scarce capital. Fiscal stimulus may temporarily give it the impression of a recovery, but it is not a genuine recovery. It makes things worse. The moment the pumping is abandoned, the true state of affairs is simply unmasked. That is exactly what happened in 1937-38. A slight tightening of monetary policy revealed the fact that the mini-boomlet was as unsound as its predecessor boom in the years prior to the 1929 crash. Now, those of you who've been listening to the wake-up call will know that I often use the analogy of the addict. In fact, I amaze myself so often at how exact that analogy is. The damnable U.S. government is the enabler. The U.S. consumer is the addict. Think about when you go to the doctor to get that sleeping pill prescription refilled and upped. Think how many doctors will just go along with your request, fearful that if they balk, you'll just go to another doctor. Isn't that exactly the same as Congress cravenly yielding to the base instincts of misguided monetary policy? Fearful that they won't get re-elected if they don't? Or Greenspan? Or Bernanke? Or, I hate to say it, Obama himself? Think what would happen if the doctor, in our example, were to refuse to fill that prescription. Think how many people would suffer excruciating withdrawal. Look what happened when cash for clunkers was discontinued. Sales of automobiles fell to multi-decade lows the following month. Look at the pain that caused dealerships nationwide. Yet it is estimated that fully 30% of those who bought new cars under the program will default. It wouldn't have been possible to hide this reality forever. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that government intervention can achieve in terms of fixing the economy through a stimulus program. The choice was in either abandoning the unsound policy and the unsound investments it produced, or careening towards a complete destruction of the currency system. You know, I stand amazed at how people can look at this, and look at Japan, and look at the housing bubble bust sequence, and still believe that monetary pumping and deficit spending are viable tools of economic policy when a bust occurs. It really boggles the mind. It reminds you of Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. In the US and globally, we are in uncharted territory. The odds are we will see many things we have never seen before as stimulus after stimulus fails to produce the desired results. The actual results, as in the examples I just cited, may very well be unbelievable to all the Keynes and monetarist clowns. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you've heard about these latest fees for the crime of paying off your credit cards every month. It appears that starting next year, Bank of America will charge a small number of customers an annual fee ranging from $29 to $99. The bank has characterized the fee as experimental. But cardholders who have never carried a balance or paid late fees could be among those affected. Citigroup, meanwhile, has started charging annual fees to cardholders who don't put more than a specific amount on their cards, typically $2,400 a year. Other banks are charging inactivity fees if customers don't use their credit cards during a specific period of time. Yep, you heard that right. You could be spanked for staying out of debt. These fees are the credit card industry's response to credit card legislation that will, among other things, restrict credit card issuers' ability to raise interest rates on existing balances. Credit card issuers are looking for ways to raise income before the new rules take effect in February. During the first quarter, 27% of credit card offers included annual fees, up from 18% a year earlier, according to Siraway Mail Monitor, a credit card direct mail tracking service. Curtis Arnold, founder of cardratings.com, says he expected credit card issuers to raise annual fees after the legislation was enacted. What he didn't expect, he says, was that good customers were going to get hit. Well, if you're lucky enough to have paid off your balances on time every month, you probably have a good credit score. And when you have a good credit, you have more choices. Call and complain, ladies and gentlemen. Check your credit score first to make sure you're on solid ground, says Adam Levin, founder of Credit.com, a consumer website. If you have a good score and you've been a good customer, the lender may be willing to waive the fee to keep your business. Weigh the benefits of rewards against the annual fee. The days when you could get a rewards card with no annual fees are numbered, Arnold says. If your rewards card charges a fee, you'll need to figure out whether the value of the rewards exceeds the fee. A lot of airline cards are not the best deal unless you can combine them with a frequent flyer plan. If you're not a frequent flyer, you're probably better off using a card that gives you cash back. As long as you can estimate how much you spend, it's easy to figure out whether you'll get enough cash back to justify the annual fee. Leave. If your credit card issuer won't waive the fee, you'll have a choice. Pay the annoying fee or close the account. Unfortunately, this decision isn't as clear-cut as it sounds, because closing an account could hurt your credit score. One of the factors used to calculate your credit score is what's known as the credit utilization ratio, which is based on the amount of credit you have outstanding as a percentage of your total available credit. When you close a credit card account, the amount of your total available credit shrinks, which could lead to a higher utilization rate. This ratio accounts for 30% of your credit score. In addition, closing an account you've owned a long time could affect your credit history, and another factor used to calculate your score. Still, if you aren't carrying balances on your other accounts and the card is relatively new, closing your account is worth considering. Even now, there are good deals out there, particularly for cardholders with good credit. For example, the Fidelity Rewards American Express card pays 2% of cash back to a Fidelity account with no limits on cash rewards and no annual fee. If you don't care about rewards and just want a credit card that doesn't charge an annual fee, consider applying for a card through a credit union. Many credit unions charge cards no annual fee and offer below average interest rates. Associations such as USAA, which provides products and services for military personnel and their families, also offer good deals on credit cards, according to Consumer Reports. All right, well, let's look at some mail. I got something from Michael McCullough on Friday after the show was over, entitled Question for the Next Wake-Up Call. Here it is. Dear Richard, I enjoyed listening to your show of the 16th of October. I have a question for you about deflation. I understand that deflation is a decrease in the general price level of goods and services. Further, deflation causes an increase in the real value of money, allowing one to buy more goods with the same amount of money. Before I continue, Michael, let me just tell you that that's not quite right. Deflation is a decrease in the supply of money and credit. The decrease in the general price of goods and services is often a corollary of the fact that there is less money going around. But the actual deflation sign comes when money is disappearing from the system. And that can happen in a number of different ways. And I have made this point several times on the show. It's one I think you should bear in mind, because there's a big difference between the general level of decline in goods and services and a decline in the money supply, which we are actually seeing right now, even though it may not be apparent to you. Anyway, let me continue with your email. My experiences over the last year in general lead me to believe that we in the United States are experiencing deflation. I ask people about their businesses wherever I go. I ask barber, the hardware store owner, the mechanic, the landscaper, the butcher, baker, the candlestick maker, etc. Business owners always respond to my inquiries by addressing the demand for their goods and services, and this makes sense because it is the lack of demand that determines prices, which in turn causes deflation. Very few businesses have reported an increase in demand for their goods and services. One area of increased demand is in the case of independent automobile mechanics. As consumers are keeping their cars instead of trading them in after 2 or 3 years, there is a greater demand for car repairs such as replacing tires, batteries, mufflers, etc. However, when I probe further into this trend, I find out that the independent mechanics are benefiting from the increased demand at the expense of the auto dealers who would have conducted the repair after the trade-in and prior to the resale of the vehicle. The independent mechanic gets the business, but the auto dealers are losing it, so there is no real increase in the demand for the service. So this leads to my first question. Is it useful to measure deflation in terms of certain sectors of the economy, such as automobile sales and services, or can deflation only be measured meaningfully in terms of the overall economy? I think the answer is the latter, because individual sectors can see inflation or deflation, but the overall trend is the only indicator upon which to base longer-term economic decisions. If I am correct, then why do economists address individual sectors, especially in the media, and not the overall economy? Well, let's just address that before we go on, and it actually requires almost like a restatement of my previous comment, Michael, which is that if you shut your eyes to what seems like the obvious, in other words, the price level of goods and services, and just concentrate on the figures that pertain to the money supply, you will see that when there is less money, basically you have less to spend. Now, this can happen for a variety of reasons. It can happen right now because of a meltdown in the financial system. It can happen because of a bona fide drop-off in economic activity. There are a number of different reasons why this can happen. But basically, when there is less money in the system, there is less to spend. And that's what causes people to buy less and thereby cause the general price level of goods and services to decline. But it does happen in that order. And it's very important to understand that, because without a decline in the amount of money in circulation, you're not going to see deflation even if the price of goods and services declines. What you're going to see is that money, which will therefore still be there, it hasn't been removed from the system, will be used to buy other things and to replace the lost goods and services with other purchases and other uses, which will maintain the general level of prices, and therefore you will not see deflation. Deflation comes as a principal phenomenon from the decline in the amount of money in circulation. And people say, well, how is this possible? Because Ben Bernanke is flooding the system with money. Well, the answer is because much more money is coming out of the system through defaults, bankruptcies, foreclosures, one thing and another, than is being put into the system, courtesy of Mr. Bernanke. So why do economists address individual sectors? Because that's what they're paid to do, Mike. I mean, you know, an economist generally is not some kind of floating phenomenon in the sky. An economist is generally a man or a woman with a job, and his job requires him to have a boss, and his boss is usually a company which has employed him to take the temperature of the economy with a view to explaining to that boss how things can be improved and what can be used in monetary terms to assist the growth of the company. Therefore, economists are by nature optimists, and it's important to understand that too, because it's very rare to come up with a pessimistic economist such as Nouriel Roubini. These people exist, hopefully at the right time in the cycle, but they are nevertheless somewhat of a rarity. Most economists, as I said, have jobs, they have families to feed, they basically are not going to risk their careers by telling everybody how bad things are going to get, and when I say risk it, what I really mean is if they're wrong, of course, they're out of a job. So much safer to be basically optimistic and hope you're right, and if you're wrong, at least your company knows you were doing what you could to further the edges of the company that you work for. Now, it can be obviously a manufacturing industrial company, it can be a financial services company, it could be a government agency, but basically economists must attempt to find solutions to problems with a view to making things get better. So that's really the answer to that particular question, hopefully, Michael. My second question is about the relationship between deflation, currencies, and commodities. Over the past year, the dollar index has been moving downward. This means the dollar has devalued against a group of other currencies. Is the dollar deflation due to its own weakness of the currency, or is the U.S. economy deflating and pulling the dollar down with it? Or is there no real difference between the two? Now, the same question in the context of commodities. Commodities as traded in dollars, such as oil or gold, have increased in value over the past year, or have they? An ounce of gold is worth approximately $100 more than it was 1 year ago, so if I sell an ounce of gold I purchased last year for $950, then I can reap $1,050 today. Has the individual commodity increased in value, or has the commodity simply held its value while the currency has devalued? Is this the same as the mechanical car dealer example above, where there is no real increase in value overall in the economy, but simply a shift in allocation from currency to commodity? Thank you again for your great show. Best regards, Michael Pacup. Well, Michael, that's a good question. It's a very good question because it brings into focus what exactly happens when a price moves. Is it indeed the price of the commodity, the price of the house, the price of the service being rendered that is moving up or down, or is it the value of the currency, which in usual times, as a fiat currency, will be losing value, as indeed has happened to the dollar since 1913, when the Federal Reserve was created, it's lost about 97% of its value. Thank you very much, Federal Reserve. The reality is that, as I've explained before, in terms of an easily identifiable commodity like gold, gold can go down in price but gain value. And the example always is that of the suit of men's clothing, which generally has been available to purchase for the price of 1 ounce of gold from Roman times all the way up to the present. Now, if gold today is trading at 1,050 and it goes down to 750, but it now buys two suits instead of one suit, then clearly the value of gold has risen even if the price has fallen. So I think the answer to your question is that you cannot deny that goods and services are falling in price. And of course, since you are paid in dollars, assuming that you do live in the United States, and apparently you do live in New York, because you say so at the end of your email, then clearly what is important to you is the price, because when the price falls, then your assets lose value. But if you were lucky enough to sell those assets before the price fell, then the amount of money gains value in relation to the assets that you sold. So it's a pretty much of a semantic, Michael, but yet the question is good because it dictates how you should invest and what you should do to combat the effects of deflation, i.e. hold on to money as opposed to goods and services. And yet, of course, when you do need to buy oil, as in feeding your motor car, then it's clear that you want to buy it as late in the cycle as you possibly can. In other words, you don't want to buy oil as a commodity and store it, just want to use it as quickly as you can. And that's why, in a different context, it pays to rent and not to own real estate in a time of deflation, because you hold on to your money for the longest time until you have to spend it in rent, as opposed to spending it in buying a piece of real estate and then watching that real estate lose value against your currency, which, of course, in this case, is the dollar. Best to hold your dollars and invest them in investments which follow the prevailing trend, which is downward, and then just use what you need piecemeal to pay rent until the cycle turns. Okay, I hope I managed to give you some insight into that particular situation there, Michael. And now we come to Steve's rent. Steve has bounced back onto the scene the first time since I bounced into Singapore with a rant, and I will explain why according to Steve's PS at the end of the rant, but let's get straight to it. Steve's rant, courtesy Steve Kruger, and here it goes. King George's tax sovereignty has to go down in history as one of the worst dictates of a king ever. Had King George acted with the deceit of a 20th century politician and just told the local governors that the tax is not a tax but an unfunded mandate, most likely he would not have inspired the American Revolution. The colonies were to levy their own taxes, not the king. This is enough to bring on the festivities of the American Revolution. Next, a quick look at King Louis and Marie Antoinette of France, great speakers, with one sentence, let them eat cake. And their inability to estimate the size of the crowd in the palace grounds, they managed to cause one of the bloodiest revolutions ever. One has to be curious as to what will be the words or events that will cause the second American Revolution. When will we the people say, we had it, and revolt? Will it be the fall of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, or our inability to sucker any nation into buying our worthless debt? Or could it be the Congress tapping us to excess? With 20 million unemployed, record foreclosures taking place, the last thing that Congress should do is raise taxes, but that is all we hear about, higher taxes. It seems to me we're steering right towards the iceberg with the attitude that if we pick up the speed, we will pass right through it. I have to vote my proxy to the iceberg on this one. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. P.S. Richard, with your moving halfway around the world, I seem to have developed a case of second-party jet lag that has caused my rants to drop off. I am working hard to catch up and rebuild this obvious character flaw. If for some reason I can't beat this problem, there will be only one avenue open to me, and that is to apply for a government bailout, as my government can fix anything. I can't believe I said that. Thank you, Steve. Back in full form. Once again, I'm sure all the listeners are delighted that that is so. Okay. Andrew Smithers of London-based research house Smithers & Company is not a man who has any truck with nonsense, particularly when it comes from the mouths of stockbrokers. In his latest report, The U.S. Stock Market, Value and Nonsense About It, he takes to task those who claim U.S. equities are still cheap. And I quote, "As we have remarked before, valid approaches to value are disliked by many practitioners as they get in the way of business. That is inherently likely, and as a glance at chart one will confirm, the stock market has been underpriced around 50% of the time. Those who sell shares would rather it were cheap 100% of the time, and therefore prefer invalid metrics. The ones used vary from time to time, as those employed are restricted to those which currently give the desired answer that stocks are cheap. Smithers says there are only two valid ways to value the market. One is by using a cyclically adjusted P/E ratio, and the other is by using the Q ratio, which compares the market capitalization of companies with their net worth adjusted to current prices. Whichever technique is used, the answer is the same. The U.S. stock market is overvalued by around 40%. That's 40, ladies and gentlemen, 40%. And Smithers explains, as the valid measures of the U.S. market show that it is currently around 40% overvalued, some ingenuity is needed to claim otherwise. The earnings per share for the past 12 months on the S&P 500 is $7.51. So, with the index at 1,071, it is selling at a trailing P/E of 142. This is far higher than it has ever been before, as the previous end month record is a P/E of 47. But current multiples are no guide to value. When depressed or elevated, they need to be adjusted to their cyclical norm. This is how the cyclically adjusted P/E is calculated. And when its current value is compared with its long-term average, using the geometric means of earnings per share and cyclically adjusted P/Es, it shows that the market is 37.7% overpriced using 10 years of earnings data and 45% if 20 years are used. This method is therefore of no use to those who sell shares or have made faulty claims about value in the past. Well, thank you, Andrew, or Andy, or whatever you call yourself. It is very hard. In fact, it gets harder and harder as the market seems to sail into the stratosphere to convince people that, in fact, it is overpriced. But as I have said so many times, we are dealing with the first of many bear market rallies that we are going to have to endure as the market falls over the next few years. Now, bear market rallies are par for the course. They are there to throw people off the scent. They are there to give people the impression that things are going to get better and better and better. They are not. They're going to get worse. And any amount of information that I can give you on the show or in the emails that I send out to people who are interested will bear that out. I have no words for people who are busy trying to support the idea of a market which simply is going up on the basis of serious fundamentals, because it's just not happening. The fundamentals are getting worse by the day. Citigroup is in dire straits. Most of the, in fact, all of the major banks are insolvent, and the only reason you don't hear about it is because they are withholding information from you. They are not telling you about real estate as derivatives which they hold off balance sheet, in other words, in secret. And they're holding the real estate in secret because they know that if they put the real estate out into the market today, two things will happen. They will flood the market and cause prices to drop, one, and they will have to note it on the balance sheet as and when they sell it at a tremendous loss, two. In other words, if they show the reality of the assets on their books, it will become immediately evident to everybody that they are indeed insolvent. And this is something that I know that all of you who listen to the show must by now be aware of. Those who read the emails, they are aware of it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a major depression. It is far worse in its intent than the depression of the 1930s. And only time will bear me out. Just like when I spoke about the housing market about to implode way back in 2004, 2005, nobody wrote in saying thank you very much for the information. Nobody knew what was going to happen. I didn't know, but I extrapolated out from the information available to me, just like I am able to do today when it comes to the price of the stock market or the commodities or bonds or anything else. And I'm not a genius. I am simply a person who likes to proceed step by step in a logical fashion until I have the information I need with which to come to you and make certain statements which hopefully will bear themselves out in the fullness of time. And I'm sorry if people like my cousin Jonathan find that objectionable and accuse me of scaremongering. I'm sorry if that's the case. I have to tell you that I have not spoken to Jonathan since this, the situation came up about 8 months ago, which is very sad. But at the same time, you know, people have a lot to lose, and you know, there's a lot at stake here. And if you see the stock market rallying like it did this morning, about 100 points in less than 5 minutes, it is because there are vested interests whose livelihoods depend on seeing the market go up. And until they are overwhelmed with the sellers, which is already starting to happen, the internals of the market are weakening significantly right now, you're going to see this huge volatility in the stock market. You'll start to see it in the real estate market as prices come down. You'll see it in commodity markets. And this is the nature of markets. And we have to sit back and we have to interpret those moves and understand them and hopefully glean some measure of information about what we see. But I am going to call people on this stuff, ladies and gentlemen, as I have done, as I did with David LeRae of the National Association of Realtors all those months, when he kept saying things were getting better, getting better, getting better, and every month the price of real estate fell. And not once in 11 months did they ever predict a fall in price for the ensuing month. Every month was always, things are getting better. We've hit the bottom, All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks as though I need to talk to you about something else which has come up, which is somewhat unpleasant but needs to be discussed. Haven't talked much about it up until now, but it is indeed an analysis of what is happening in the pension market, because obviously there are now steep losses in pensions and pension funds. You know, the financial crisis has blown a hole in the rosy forecasts of pension funds that cover teachers, police officers, and other government employees, casting into doubt as never before whether these public systems will be able to keep their promises to future generations of retirees. The upheaval on Wall Street has deluged public pension systems with losses that government officials and consultants increasingly say are insurmountable unless pension managers fundamentally rethink how they pay out benefits or make money or both. It seems that within 15 years, public systems on average will have less than half the money they need to pay pension benefits. And that comes from an analysis by PricewaterhouseCoopers. Other analysts are saying that funding levels could hit that low within a decade. After losing about $1 trillion in the markets, state and local governments are now facing a devil's choice. Either slash retirement benefits or pursue high return investments that, of course, come with high risk. The urgent need for outsized returns by these vast public pension funds, which must hit high investment targets year after year to keep pace with rising retirement costs, is in turn fueling a renewed appetite for risk on Wall Street. Before the crisis, many public pension funds had experimented with risky trading techniques or committed more of their money to hedge funds and other non-traditional firms, which in turn invested some of it in complex mortgage securities. When these melted down, pension funds got burnt. Well, now they're facing an even bigger funding gap, and some systems are investing in the same securities, betting that a rebound in their value will generate huge returns. Peter Austin, the executive director of the New York Mellon Pension Services, he said this. He said, the amount that needs to be made up is enormous. Frankly, they are forced to continue their allocation in these high return asset classes because that's their only hope. Well, some pension experts say the funding gap has become so great that no investment strategy can close it and the taxpayers will have to cover the massive bill. The problem isn't limited to public pension funds. Many corporate pension funds have lost so much ground that they are also pursuing riskier investments. And they too could end up a taxpayer burden if they cannot meet their obligations and are taken over by the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp. Public systems still have enough to meet their current obligations. If governments take no action, retirees could keep drawing full benefits for the foreseeable future, even under the most pessimistic projections. But already, some funds are seeking to trim benefits to conserve money. Some governments have also proposed increasing the amount of public money paid each year into the funds. In practice, however, some political leaders have begun doing the opposite, cutting annual contributions to pension funds as a way of balancing state and local budgets buffeted in the recession by falling tax revenue and rising costs. All around the country, governments are struggling with the pact they've made with employees. In New Mexico, lawmakers passed legislation this year requiring public employees to contribute about 1.5% of their salary to cover retirement benefits. Labor unions representing 57,000 of the workers sued the state in response. In Philadelphia, officials delivered an ultimatum to state lawmakers. Allow the city to take a 2-year break from contributing to its pension system, or Philadelphia would lay off 3,000 workers and cut sanitation and public safety services. Last month, the lawmakers not only granted the request, but extended the funding holiday to thousands of cities and despite severe pension deficits in many of these places. In Montgomery County, officials last year committed to setting up an investment fund to finance about $3 billion in retiree health care benefits promised to employees. But when it came time to put the first round of seed money into the fund this year, county officials balked, citing budget constraints. Chief Administrative Officer Timothy L. Feierstein said, "We know we've got huge healthcare liability. Our plan was to work gradually to fund that. And this year, we abandoned that plan." Just a few years ago, it seemed far-fetched that Virginia's pension system would hit hard times. In 2003, the state's primary funds, pension funds, either had more money than they needed or, at minimum, were nearly fully funded. And like their counterparts across the country, state officials assumed they would earn around 8% a year from investing in financial markets for years to come, given the outstanding performance of stocks in the 1980s and 90s. But officials in Virginia and elsewhere soon began to wonder whether those two decades were a fluke. As pension deficits began to rise, officials questioned whether the assumptions were too optimistic. In 2006, Virginia's pension officials suggested scaling back benefits or requiring current employees to begin paying into the pension fund. The state's lawmakers took no action. Then the crisis hit. Virginia lost 21% of the value of its portfolio, or about $11.5 billion. Maryland and D.C., meantime, suffered drops of 20%. The losses were typical of what pension funds suffered around the country. State and local government officials had predicted before the crisis they would have $3.6 trillion in their accounts by now, according to the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Today, they are $1.2 trillion short of that mark. While pension funds were not equally affected, officials in Arlington County, for instance, say their funding levels remain above 90%. And even those that suffered huge losses say they had saved enough money to pay out retirement benefits for years to come. Virginia, for instance, still has nearly $43 billion in its accounts. But Virginia officials now estimate the funding level of its major pension funds will sink to about 60% by 2013. From there, the deficit will grow even wider, according to Kim Nickel, the national director of PricewaterhouseCoopers public sector retirement practice. Even if public funds were to hit their 8% investment targets every year, Nickel calculated they would have less than half of what they needed by 2025. This is because a greater share of the population will be retired, and those who are will live longer, collecting thus benefits longer, she said. And I quote, "I don't think you can invest your way out of this. Plans are going to have to make changes. The scale of the losses was just so great, and the liabilities are growing up so fast, much faster than they can keep up." For these reasons, billionaire investor Warren Buffett has called these pensions ticking time bombs. The financial crisis, experts say, shortened the fuse. Last month, Virginia Governor Timothy N. Kaine signaled that he would consider the politically sensitive step of requiring the state's 100,000 employees to contribute part of their 2011 salaries towards their pensions. But the two candidates running to replace him, and who would have to carry out the proposal, have said they oppose it. This is the dilemma confounding pension funds as they emerge from the wreckage of the financial crisis. If they shy away from riskier investments, they would be settling for lower returns and leave future shortfalls unaddressed. But by aggressively pursuing the higher rates of return they need, pension funds increase the chances that they will be burned again by investment bets gone bad. Sue Uran, managing director of the Pew Center on the States, which plans to release a report on pension losses within weeks, said, and I quote, "State pension funds face enormous pressure trying to recover their investment losses. It will be tempting for them to consider investments that promise a high rate of return." End of quote. Well, traditional investment strategies which rely on stocks haven't fared too well in recent years. To meet their obligations to retirees, pension funds tend to assume they will earn an 8% return on investments each year. The stock market, as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, is actually down 32% this decade. Like many states, Maryland had begun moving money from stocks into hedge funds and private equity before the financial crisis. The goal was not only to earn a higher return, but to diversify the investment portfolio. Should stocks sink, the thinking went, less traditional investments might hold up. The financial crisis offered a shocking retort. Nearly all investments, save for government bonds, tumbled at the same time. Yet Maryland is now continuing its shift away from stocks and into non-traditional investments. Pension officials argue they have little choice. "How do I act in the new environment? There really aren't any ready answers for that," said Vansco Perry, Chief Investment Officer for Maryland's pensions. "But I had difficulty throwing away 30 to 40 years worth of knowledge and practice and say that doesn't work anymore." Some pension funds are also continuing to engage in other investment practices that got them in trouble during the crisis. One such trade technique is called securities lending. In this transaction, a pension fund lends a stock it holds to a hedge fund and receives cash in return as collateral. The deal is meant to provide a twofold benefit. The pension fund could make money by investing the cash collateral and can continue to benefit from the stock through its dividends and any appreciation in its value. Before the crisis, states committed billions of dollars to this practice. But when the credit market seized up last year, pension funds got stuck. They couldn't access the investments they made with the cash collateral. Some had to sell off other investments at a loss to pay retiree benefits. California's pension fund lost $634 million from securities lending as of March 31st, but the total could reach $1 billion after a full accounting is done, according to a report from the systems consultant Wilshire Associates. Still, the pension fund says it remains committed to the practice because it boosted returns in the two decades before the final meltdown. Pension funds have also been aggressively pushing into real estate and troubled mortgage securities that were crushed in the crisis. California's pension fund is putting $2 billion into buying these toxic bank assets. Financial analysts say the prices for these assets have fallen so far that they may be a better bet than in the past. But the crisis showed how unreliable these investments can be, and their prices may yet to hit rock bottom. In August, California's pension fund took a similar gamble by investing $463 million in a shopping centers across 17 states and the District of Columbia, though many experts forecast a prolonged slump in commercial real estate. Even if strategies do succeed, the shortfall will still be insurmountable. During the last fiscal year, Ohio's fund lost 31%. Its most recent annual report details how long it would take now for its investments to put the fund back on track. Officials simply said, infinity. Very, very grim, ladies and gentlemen. This is, as I say, a depression the likes of which have never even been dreamt about. And it is up to all of us to do what we have to do, and I will do my part to help you do just that. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, wishing you an excellent week ahead, and I will be back with you same time, same place on Friday. Thank you, and bye-bye for now.